Well, thank you, and thank you all for being here this evening. And dear Sid, dear colleague and friend. You know, Sid, in reading the book, I thought it was really marvelous how you made this very personal. Uh-huh. And it was very much about the people who were affected by the disorder and very much about the people who dedicated their lives to finding a way to understand it and treat it. And I couldn't help but think about how I had known you at a time before you had really made the commitment to become a cancer physician and a cancer researcher. And so I wonder if I could maybe turn the light on that just a bit. And if you could, we first met, just for the audience, when we were you were at the Mass General doing your internal medicine residency, and we had a chance to have a discussion over topics related to viruses that caused cancer. But at that point, I think you were still in the process of making decisions. So why is it that cancer became a focus of your professional life?
I actually remember that meeting very, very well. Among other things, many people might know this, David was one of the first people to treat AIDS patients, particularly AIDS patients with malignancies, with cancers. It's a somewhat little-known fact, I think, about the history of AIDS in the public realm, David, that in fact the very first physicians to treat AIDS patients were not people who specialized in viruses or bacteria, but people who specialized in cancer. Because many of these, at that point in time, many of these young men, one of the first manifestations that they had were these peculiar cancers that began to sprout out of nowhere. These Kaposi sarcomas, which had never been seen in young men. I mean, imagine the terror of that moment.
Right.
You know, you're going about your business in New York or San Francisco, and all of a sudden this blue-black tumor, which has only been seen in elderly men, starts sprouting up in your body. Or lymphomas, which is obviously an area that you specialized in. So, in fact, if I remember correctly, a lot of this first conversation focused around that moment of these AIDS patients, which that you were taking care of in Boston. I had come at that point in time, I was an intern, I was just beginning my career in medicine, and I had come out of the laboratory in England, where we had been working on viruses that cause cancer. Epstein-Barr virus was the virus that I was particularly studying. And I became fascinated by the idea that viruses could cause cancer, and that there was this odd link in AIDS patients whose immune systems were being depleted, and then they were getting cancer. So that idea began to fascinate me, and it was a transition from the cellular world, which is what I was studying in England, to the macroscopic real world of humans, and how can one make that leap? How could one convert the microscopic universe that we inhabit in the laboratory into real human beings whose lives are being devastated by various illnesses, in particular cancer? And the reason I think that I was attracted to coming and working with you was that you made that transition daily. In other words, you were in the laboratory studying the cells, and 20 minutes later had walked across and you were seeing real human beings. So that was very crucial for me.
You know, and I have to say, I think that notion of being able to go from the laboratory to the patient was something that was a requirement, because there were patients of great need, clearly vexed by a problem where we had very little understanding.
Yes.
And it was new, it was emerging, it wasn't an ageless problem the way most cancers are, many chronic diseases are. This was something that was newly occurring in the context of our modern environment. We had to figure that out.
Yeah.
Because who knew the boundaries?
Yes.
Who would be affected? How would they be affected? And to get some kind of boundaries on that required that we start to investigate things in the laboratory. And I do think that, for me, that was actually a very compelling part of the story. I hadn't known that that was the case for you as well. And I think that's really quite wonderful to know that we, again, share that. I have to say, one of the things that I found in my own work is that, to some extent, getting engaged in this problem is also a bit of a compulsion, because it is such a horrifying problem.
Yeah.
That cancer has a fearsome dimension to it that I think we all feel. And as there has been better control of things like the acute cardiac event mm-hmm. and some of the other issues that have been a major problem in health, that shadow of cancer remains in a very devastating way for all of us. For me personally, it was something that had affected my family. Was your engagement in it in some part a process by which you could gain control over something that was itself a demon for you?
Yeah, it's an important question because it's the book. I mean, I was in the trenches. Hmm. I was going about. I would wake up at 5:30 in the morning, round on my patients, go to the seminars, round back on the patients, go to clinic. This is the life of a fellow learning the ropes of cancer medicine, rotating from one clinic to another clinic to another clinic. And there was a moment in all of this when I felt that my nose was so close to the ground that I couldn't take a back step. Mm. And patients wanted us as a community of physicians, as a community of scientists, to take that back step. Because they were saying to me, well, of course, let's talk about what's going on in my situation today, right now, but tell me a little bit about the bigger picture. Tell me why we are doing this in the context of what's happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And really, ultimately, it was one woman who I was treating who said, you know, I'm willing to go on, but I need to know what it is that I'm battling. It was a very elemental question. I mean, you know, it's a question that every patient ultimately asks you in some form or another. What is it? What is cancer? What is its history? Why are we here today? Right. And what happens next? So in that sense, it was an attempt. I took a step back and I said to myself, wait a second. Here is this woman who is in the midst of just a terrifying time in her life. And I can't provide, or really as a community, we haven't provided her with a kind of skeleton to tell her how this story evolved.
Right.
What is her history? What is my shared history with her? And so in that sense, I began to write this book. And the book was a much smaller book. It was a journal. Hmm. And then started becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and ultimately grew into a doorstop.
A well-thumbed doorstop.
Exactly, exactly.
I have to say, one of the wonderful things in reading this is to put it in counterpoint to much of the way we were taught and we teach oncology. And that is, it's often we are very concerned about what did yesterday's trial tell us about the patient? What do we learn that is the most immediate knowledge? And it very rarely puts things into the historic context. And I must say, by having a chance to see it through the eyes that you have created now for all of us, it really does give us a much greater sense about where there were false steps, mm-hmm. where there were opportunities missed, put aside, returned to. And to some extent, that does give hope. It makes it a bit more of a process in which we engage over time with our colleagues, with a broader community, than it is of today's study shows this, and it's, that gives it a much more shallow dimension. I find that this is the sort of thing that I think we should be teaching our oncologists, and every oncologist, I think, should read this.
No, thank you.
But I think that counterpoint is one that I find very powerful, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you've thought about if that was part of the process that you went through in writing it.
Certainly it was. I mean, there's a point in the book in which I say that, scientists are more obsessed with history hmm. than historians. There's a reason behind this. Science, as you know, is one of the most compelling continuous conversations we've had as human beings in our history. In fact, it is quite amazing, isn't it, that we pick up a paper in 2011, a scientific paper in 2011, and in fact, you're communicating through a series of generations right. with someone who may have died in 1922.
Right.
We're still having this communication. Just to give you one example of this, there are many in the book, but one example of this is every time I prescribe a drug like tamoxifen to treat breast cancer, actually the lineage of that medicine is very interesting. It begins with a Scottish surgeon who's traveling the hills of Scotland, and he overhears a rumor, just a rumor, that this is in the 1860s or 70s. He overhears a rumor, his name is George Beatson, and he overhears a rumor among the shepherds in the hills of Scotland that somehow removing the ovaries of a cow affects the way the cow produces milk. Now, this is a time when no one knows anything about hormones. Nothing is known about anything, any connection with ovaries and the breast. But Beatson overhears this, and he says to himself, wait a second, there must be some connection, obviously, between the ovaries and the breast. And if so, maybe there's a connection between ovaries and breast cancer. Mm. And just as an experiment, he says, well, why don't I try to perform ovarian surgery on women with breast cancer? Now, this is radical beyond belief in the 1880s. It's like saying, you have brain cancer, I'm going to cut off a piece of your finger to try to treat your brain cancer. But he's acting on a kind of whim to some extent, but he's also really picking up that rumor and converting that process into an experiment. And he does this. And then three of the patients, they go into remission. The breast cancer goes into remission when the ovary is removed. So from this is seeded the idea that there must be a circuit, some kind of molecule that the ovary secretes that keeps breast cells alive and breast cancer cells alive, some breast cancer cells alive. And eventually, that molecule turns out to be estrogen. Right. And from estrogen, you get an inhibitor of estrogen or estrogen signaling called tamoxifen. Now, isn't that an incredible journey?
Fabulous. Well, and let's stay with that historic theme for a moment, because you also bring up issues related to Galen.
Yes.
And Galen may not be familiar to the audience, so let me just mention. Galen was someone working in, he was, in some ways, he was the emergency room doctor for the gladiators in the first century AD. His background, he had really come out of the tradition of Hippocrates and Aristotle, a very ideological perspective. Mm-hmm. That is that everything in the natural world was divided into four parts.
Yes.
And that everything in the body was divided into four humors. Mm-hmm. And that those balances had to be kept in place. And Galen then tried to provide something of an empiric approach to this and started to give us some sense about how there were things that were different than the Aristotelian notion, but still very much based on that notion. And in fact, he then ended up talking about the blood in terms of it being in two different circulatory systems. Mm-hmm. And they didn't connect except through pores in the heart. Mm-hmm. And that the pumping was actually due to the arteries, like a bellows, pulling blood in and out, swishing back and forth, and the veins doing the same. That notion was entirely consistent with the rational world that had been provided to him by Hippocrates, mm-hmm. was something that people viewed as absolutely had to be the case, was the nature of medical teaching for over 1,200 years, and it was dead wrong.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think about what we know about cancer today and think about cancer today. I mean, clearly some of the concepts have been proven wrong and have changed. And yet we all know that some of our knowledge is so highly context-dependent that things that we feel we can stand on as rock-solid ground now may actually be a bit wobbly.
Right.
Do you see any current
fractures in the firmament? Well, I do. It's one of the great fears, but also one of the great excitements in medicine, isn't it? When you know that there has to be a wrong theory in there. Because the data don't fit your model, right? It's one of the most important moments in the disjunction between the lack of fitting. You know, everything goes along as you know, the philosophers of science have described this process very well. Everything goes along hunky dory, and you're living in a very stable universe where there are four fluids and six types of animals and three types of human personalities, and then all of a sudden there comes a man carrying an animal with a bottle of fluid that doesn't fit into any of those pictures. And you say to yourself, wait a second, either the man doesn't exist, I'm going to try to block him out and his animal and his fluid, or I have to change my theory.
Yeah.
It's a very frightening but simultaneously a very exciting moment. And in fact, the fact that we can do that to me is very positive. There's a quote in the book, I say that, you know, ideology corrupts absolutely. scientists are ideologues, like
absolutely,
like all other human beings. I mean, why would they be different? There's an one has the impression that the scientist is somehow kind of a cold, futuristic figure who sits in his or her ivory tower, opining coldly about the nature of reality. In fact, that's absolutely
uncolored by
cultural, exactly,
which is not that.
But that's absolutely incorrect, right? Right. Scientists are very much immersed in culture. They obviously define culture to some extent, but they're very much immersed in it. And that when the cultural break happens, it's intense, I think.
Absolutely. And so I wonder, you know, one of the things that I think we have focused on in the cancer world is very strong emphasis on what are the genetics of the abnormal cell.
Yes.
And it's been a very strong orientation that has been very powerful in terms of what it's taught us. But I can't help but think the idea that cancer represents a rogue cell,
yes,
that somehow descends from Mars almost, is a way that is comfortable for us,
yes,
but actually doesn't reflect completely the biology, and that we're missing an opportunity to think of it in the context in which it resides. That maybe we should be thinking of cancer more as a tissue, mm-hmm, than as a cell. I wonder what you think of that.
I have several thoughts about it. I wrote a piece in the New York Times talking about some of these theories of cancer, some of which actually you've demonstrated in the laboratory. And to me, what's interesting is we used to think, as I said, of cancer as a single cell and a homogeneous cell, a homogeneous, yes, population of cells. So it's a little bit like saying the entirety of a tumor consists of 10,000 identical, clonally identical cells, like a big army, like, yes, one of these armies from Star Wars, made up of 10,000 identical clonal members,
right,
a big white army of people carrying whatever the instruments they carry in Star Wars. That used to be the
very
old
cool
model. That used to be the old model. But the new model, or one of the new models, is much more interesting, and that is that, in fact, this the thing that we call a tumor isn't made up of 10,000 identical clones, but in fact has many different variants inside it already.
Hmm.
So some are white soldiers, some of them are black, some of them are blue, some of them are red, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the kicker. The kicker is that if you have a drug and you use this to wipe out these individual soldiers, as it were, all the white soldiers might die, but there might be two red soldiers that are left because they're immune to the drug. The drug doesn't work on them.
Mm.
And now, once you've taken the drug away, these two soldiers now repopulate,
right,
this entire cancer. And then this process goes on over and over again. And what's interesting to me is a great philosophically interesting idea, which is that the biology that guides regeneration, the very biology that guides the capacity of cells to regenerate themselves, stem cells, is being reflected in cancer.
Hmm.
To me, that's a fascinating new idea, which is we used to think, and again, philosophically speaking, what a peculiar juxtaposition.
Right.
Regeneration, the ultimate disease of degeneration, to some extent, cancer,
right,
and regeneration put right against each other in a way that's surprising and that we just fully don't understand.
And that population of cells, those stem cells that we think of as in many ways the most extraordinary, optimistic, creative entity,
yeah,
that could be in the body, do actually represent something of an existential threat, don't they? I mean, they have,
yes,
this dark side.
Yeah.
And that because they have this capacity to regenerate themselves repeatedly, that if they accumulate, if they acquire a genetic injury, they will pass it on to all of their offspring.
Yes.
More mature cell populations are destined to go on to die. Stem cells are hardwired to live essentially forever.
Yes.
And so they could become that source of cancer. It may be one of the reasons why we have relatively small number of stem cells.
Yes.
That they are actually pretty well guarded and defended. But it does raise this issue of, are these the cells that go awry? Are they the problem?
Yeah.
Do we think of stem cells as the source of cancer?
And I mean, just to talk about one particular stem cell, just to give a very concrete example, you know this very well, but many people find this fact. To me, it was a very surprising fact when I began in the field. you can take one single one blood stem cell, and you can drain all the blood in your body, you can drain all the blood in my body, and you can send that one single cell, and over time, it will repopulate the entirety of your blood. And you can drain your blood again, and that single cell will repopulate the entirety of your blood. It will regenerate the entirety of your blood again. So that's the regenerative power living inside that cell. And to me, what the dark side is, imagine, so what's very important about that cell is that it regenerates the entirety of your blood, but then it knows how to stop regenerating the entirety of your blood. That's what's amazing to me, right? So how that cell knows, the cell knows that now I'm replete with blood, and now I'm going to stop. But what if that cell doesn't know when to stop?
Right.
What if it keeps regenerating and regenerating more and regenerating more? This idea of renewal, self-renewal, without self-control.
Right.
And that ultimately could be one reason that blood cancers arise,
right.
That this cell is unable to stop its process of continuously, that something has gone wrong genetically, that it's unable to stop regenerating and repopulating, and it won't stop.
You know, and I think you point out one of the, I think, very powerful ways in which stem cell biology, which has largely been thought of a way in which we can essentially create replacement parts,
yes,
has as almost an unintended consequence taught us something very important about
I think
cancer.
It's an intended consequence, actually.
Well, I mean,
exactly.
But the field,
yes,
has in some ways backed into new ways of illuminating the cancer
absolutely
problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it's actually pointed out a, if you will, a current in thinking more broadly about some of the rules that govern how our tissues are organized, created, and as you say, governed in terms of when they stop.
Right.
Those lessons from development that we all go through early in the formation of normal tissues are ones that we think we should also be examining, not just to better understand what happens in the normal process, but also potentially
right
to understand if they are co-opted and setting
and
up
again,
cancer.
Isn't that an amazing phenomenon in science that you have now juxtaposed normal development, the way our arms grow, our legs grow, our bodies grow, against cancer?
Right.
I mean, this is a century ago, this would have been thought of, or in Galen's time, no one would have even imagined that
right
that would be the case. In other words, that by studying the normal genesis of blood, you would actually begin to understand leukemia. In fact, the most important insights, contemporary insights, into the biology of blood cancer would come from the study of the normal genesis of blood. And it has, of course, as you know very well, and maybe we should talk a little bit about it, it has important political implications. We want cures for cancer as a nation, but we don't want to study evolution. Right? But, you know, science doesn't come like
a
restaurant menu.
It's just a theory.
Right? It's not a restaurant menu. You can't say, I'm not going to take part, you know, I don't want the bean soup, but I'll have the chicken. Because unfortunately, the problem is the bean soup is part of the whole menu.
Yeah.
You can't say to yourself that I'm not going to, you know, do one part and do the next. And I don't know, you know, maybe talk a little bit, tell us a little bit about your experience with all this, because, I mean, the stem cell funding situation is much similar, isn't it? I mean, you know, on one hand, you're using stem cells
yes
to understand cancer. You can't say to yourself, I want to cure cancer, but I'm going to look away at the stem cells. Well, what was that experience like for
you? You know, and it is something that did come up very directly in stem cells, because as you know, the blood stem cell that we're talking about is representative of an entire class of stem cells that we think of as not just restricted to the blood, but also present in the skin and the skeleton and the nervous system. All of those are regarded as the adult stem cells. But of course, we learned a great deal about them from understanding the embryonic stem cell, and comparing and contrasting them was actually, it provided, if you will, binocular vision.
Right.
And yes, you could study one without the other.
Yes.
But yes, you could also walk around with.
You could walk around,
and you would run in the risk. Yeah. So I think there are ways in which we have to be mindful, of course, of science can cross boundaries.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And the book is replete with many stories.
Exactly, and yeah. It has, absolutely. That we have in our enthusiasm and our ideology, at some points, really crossed lines. And so I think it's very important as scientists that we incorporate and are sensitive to those concerns in society. But it is, I think, a damaging constraint when elements of politics and ideology affect the ability to use a full spectrum of inquiry when we're dealing with problems of such magnitude
exactly,
and of
yeah.
such great concern. So, well, we share that view. You know, one of the things that, as we're talking about policy, the notion that we're making headway, it's rather interesting that, as you point out in the book, there was an enthusiasm for initially getting engaged in cancer research during a time of what some would consider one of the most malignant chief executive officers in the White House, and he actually ended up creating the war on cancer.
You're talking about Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon.
Yes.
And his impact on this problem is enormous.
Yes.
Now, it, for many years, not so long ago, was the subject of much criticism.
Mm-hmm.
That, yes, there was money spent, but had we really actually achieved anything in the war on cancer? And I wonder if you could speak to that issue of how critically important the kinds of long-term views, extensive engagement from agencies like the government matter.
It's a rich topic, but let's backtrack a little bit to Nixon to start with, to start that discussion. You know, Nixon said late in his career, he said that his singular achievement, if there's one thing he wanted to be remembered by, it was the launching of the war on cancer.
Yeah.
It was his proudest moment. He was responding ultimately, of course, to a kind of milieu in which there was a pressure to create this. Patients and advocates, people like Mary Lasker,
right.
Were very much part of this putting pressure on Richard Nixon. Mary Lasker, someone described to me as a woman who had never heard the word no.
Hmm.
She almost single-handedly transformed the landscape of philanthropy around medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quote in my book, again, borrowed from someone. She said, well, Mary Lasker was not a fundraiser, she was a friend-raiser.
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction is critical, because anyone can raise money. It's the capacity to change minds that was very crucial. And ultimately, she prevailed, she and many of her colleagues prevailed on Richard Nixon to create the war on cancer. Now, as you know, there was an enormous resistance to that idea, for several reasons. One important idea was that wars are only launched on known enemies.
Right.
You have to know thine enemy to launch a war. You have to perceive what the problems are. And the question is, in 1971, did we know cancer? Bruce Chabner, who's a mentor colleague of both of ours, said that it's a little bit like saying that you're going to launch a rocket to the moon, but you don't know Newton's laws.
Yes.
You can do it, in principle, if you throw a rocket hard enough.
Yeah.
It's possible to do it. But you need to know Newton's laws, otherwise you'll miss the moon. because, you know, orbits are complex. So that feeling was very much there among scientists, particularly saying to themselves, you know, we don't know what we're fighting, so how can we fight a war? What does it mean to fight a war?
Right.
On the flip side, I think what this whole idea of the war on cancer did was that it humanized the problem.
Mm.
And it shook away a kind of nihilism that had existed before then. A nihilism that, you know, this problem is so big that we'll never be able to solve it.
Right.
And it began a conversation of long-term support for both clinical sciences and basic medical research, basic biological research, which ultimately bore fruit in the 1980s and 1990s.
Right.
So I think, you know, we look upon the idea, particularly now, we have a very jaundiced way of looking back at the idea of a war on cancer. But I think there were many positive benefits of that. And one of the things that happened was an enormous investment, a national investment in the National Cancer Institute, which, you know, the National Cancer Institute looks, the budget of the National Cancer Institute looks like this, and 1971 hits, and the budget begins to look like this. And notice where my hand is going.
Yeah.
But this long-term investment was very crucial, and it led to real human medicines, medicines that are transformative for many cancers. Leukemia is testicular cancer.
Extraordinary. I mean, I have to say, even during the interval of my career, things that we had regarded as really very almost hopeless settings, mortality is of 90%. We have therapies where survival and cure rate is now 90%.
Yeah.
And
well, you saw that, David. Tell us about one such, I mean, you saw that. Tell us about one such example.
Yes, well, I will. So there's one really wonderful example, because it really also points out the power of serendipity.
Right.
And the need to have an open-minded perspective about things that may not come from the traditional routes that you think of for therapy development. Very important for us today, I think. It was a setting in which there was a subtype of leukemia. There was a time that we were starting to gain a sense of those leukemias were not just, that we could not just look at the cells, but we actually had some idea, a way to understand the genetics of the cells. And we could really clearly distinguish these different entities. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that complexity has continued to grow. Mm-hmm. But at least we could break it down into time.
Leukemia type A, type B, type C.
There were five.
Yeah.
And one of those was something that people in China have been working on. And you refer to this in the book.
Yeah.
As a way to try to use what had been traditional remedies. And what was understood was that there was a particular genetic alteration. Then there was this, what was a compound that was essentially not in any way a designed connection, but was found to have a huge impact on the abnormal genes that are part of this cancer.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And by virtue of people in China being willing to take the risk of trying it in patients, something that they would have had difficulty with here, convincing people who were trying to make sense of the genetics that it was worth testing, we went from a therapy that had been essentially unsuccessful to something that was both relatively non-toxic and powerfully successful.
Absolutely.
And provided a new model, actually, because much of what cancer is, we talked about this issue of it being an abnormal growth, but it's also part of this, and we could talk about the different features of cancer, but one of them is also that the cells are growing, but they're failing to proceed through what is the natural progression of their maturity.
And once again, the question of development comes in, right?
Yes, exactly.
Arrested
so they're
development.
Stuck. They are the adolescent who never grows up.
Yes.
The Peter Pan of cancer.
Yes, exactly.
So,
don't repeat this to anyone else.
No,
cancer is the adolescent who doesn't grow up.
And that population suddenly had the ability to get through that blockade.
Yeah.
By doing so, the power of that was that those cells then move through this phase of cells where proliferation is part of their natural behavior to where the cells become mature and dying is a part of their program. And so now, suddenly, these patients went from untreatable, explosive growth, highly treated, normal-looking cells, cured. And
what an amazing moment. I mean, you know, you live your career in medicine for these moments to some extent, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you live in for many other reasons. But this was, I mean, I remembered in interviewing people, people would say this form of leukemia was the most hopeless. It was the most complicated. The patients would come in with the most complications.
Yes.
They were touch and go.
Bleeding.
And then, all of a sudden, and this one medicine, and now it becomes the most treatable form of leukemia. And this reminds me of something. I do the rounds with the residents and interns, much like you did with me. And I say to them, you know what's amazing to me is that we don't know whether the next cancer, which undergoes this kind of amazing transformation, is going to be melanoma. We don't know whether it's going to be triple-negative breast cancer. And in an odd way, that forces us to to care for patients in the most full manner possible, because the nature of hope is so serendipitous and bizarre. Mm. Now, isn't that a weird thing? In other words, we are bound to take care of patients, not cure patients, but care, to take care of patients, because we don't know the future. And therefore, we have to commit ourselves to understanding what's now, what happens now, so that we can open the door. I mean, in 1965, you could have said, well, you know, this leukemia, to talk about this particular one, this leukemia is so hopeless that why bother? Why test all these medicines? It's just it's a completely hopeless situation. Yeah. Let's just, you know, throw our hands up and say, it's going to be tough and it's not going to happen. But someone bothered. Someone bothered.
Absolutely.
And and that's the kind of urgency, I think. It's like the pill against nihilism.
Is
the fact that the future is constantly surprising us. And if you don't, therefore, if you're not willing to open yourself to the future, you'll close the lives of many, many men and women who you will eventually help.
That's why I think there's something so precious about the institutions that allow those collisions to occur, where people who are in training are meeting people who are excited about the potential, even though they know it's a difficult, long road.
Mm-hmm.
Can we also talk about one other element of this, which is we've talked a little bit about getting to new therapies, and there's a tremendous concern on the part of many in the pharmaceutical industry that the pipeline is drying up. Some of the new therapies are coming out of places that were unforeseen, like this approach using an unusual compound from not a pharmaceutical source. We think about some of the technologies that were emerging that had an impact on drug development in the book. Some of them were actually, again, by this serendipitous intersection. We just think about Sydney Farber.
Mm-hmm.
People were looking at folate and its and drugs that would have an impact on it, and he then put it together with something that would have an impact on leukemia. So what can we do now to try to foster a context in which we can take advantage of some technologies that aren't today immediately applied to cancer, but which might be ones that ultimately yield something of importance?
I think one of the crucial problems that we're facing is that we can't recruit. We're having troubles keeping scientists be scientists. And you know, technologies like physics, which we've not fully engaged. It seems to me, what's scary to me, you know, the Japanese talk about the lost decade. I wonder if we, what bothers me, what scares me, is the idea of a lost decade of molecules, a lost decade of genes. If we somehow didn't get our acts together, what if we began to lose a decade of science? And what's important to me is that it's our decade of science. In fact, this is the decade in which members of this audience, you, me, will encounter cancer.
Right.
That is a statistical reality. I'm not even making up the numbers. It is a statistical reality. If we lose this decade, which has come up with a lot of knowledge behind us, it seems the prospect really, really concerns me. In the most selfish manner possible.
Absolutely.
And so what are the sciences we're not engaging? Well, I mean, are we fully engaging the chemists?
Sure.
Are we fully engaging
the computational?
I mean, the people who work, you know, there's the people who can process information, because ultimately biology, cancer is about information. The cell trades information just like you and I are trading information. And so people who work with large amounts of information can help us understand the information trade that goes on within a cell. The biophysical world, the biochemical world, I mean, it just worries me that here's a problem that should require the fusion of every piece of technology that we have. We should be completely open to the idea that maybe somewhere in the chemical world is lurking the next major medicine. Maybe somewhere in the computational world is the solution to why the cell keeps regenerating. Maybe somewhere in the, you know, in the physical world lies a therapy to prevent or detect early cancers. And what worries me is that if we lose that for a decade, like the so-called Japanese lost decade, we will have paid a deep, steep price for it.
Yes, yes. And you know, I think as we think about how those events might be fostered rather than lost, people often think that scientists are very protective of their information and are very limited in the way that they're willing to share. I mean, my experience, and I'd be interested in hearing yours, is actually just the opposite.
Yeah, it's true.
That people are very excited about trying to get information from these other fields. Part of the problem is that we need settings where there is the convergence
yes.
of people with these kinds of areas of emphasis, where we can have the almost serendipitous interaction that can lead to something quite powerful. And I think we've all had that in our
yeah,
careers, right?
Absolutely.
Where it's the chance conversation.
Yes.
I hate to say it, but it was actually that I shared the men's room with one of the with the imaging biologists, where we came up with an idea
yes.
of looking at something very fundamental
yeah.
through his technology and
so
very fundamental, yes. I would say. But
imaging in the men's room.
Any event, the but you know the create environments in which those kinds of events can occur is not a trivial undertaking. It's very difficult to do it on the cheap.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to do it in an over-engineered way.
Yes.
So I think for a lot of us, as we see this constraint on cost and a great deal of concern about federal dollars going into what are enterprises where there isn't a very clear immediate direct benefit, you really, like you, I share this concern that we may be losing something. Do you see, if you talk to junior people today, do you get a sense that there is an unwillingness to engage?
Let me talk
issue?
For 2 seconds though, on the upside,
yeah.
in the sense of you know what we where we might be today,
yeah.
And how transformative it could be, and to some extent how transformative it has been, and then come back to this because the idea one of the things that the genetics of cancer is telling us is again just to talk about very simple principles. We now know that cancers in general, although it's not one disease, it's many diseases, they share some fundamental principles. All these forms of cancer share some fundamental principles, and one of these fundamental principles is that they're often comprised of cells that are unable to stop growing. To some extent, they're unable to stop dying, and the imbalance of growth and death creates a constant cycle of more and more and more and more cells, and ultimately cancer develops as a consequence of this. It's a kind of a loose framework. What causes these cells to keep growing continuously? Well, we now know that there are genes that control the growth of all cells. It's an amazing thing that when you cut yourself, your wound heals, and then it knows when to stop healing, because there are genes that tell cells to continue to grow, close up the wound. And then there are other genes that will tell the cell to stop growing once the wound is closed up. That's normal development. That's normal wound healing. Cancer occurs when the genes that are telling the cells to go get interrupted, or the genes that are telling the cell to stop are interrupted. And someone, Harold Varmus, among other people, has likened this to being an accelerator and a brake problem. So in other words, it's being like being in a terrifying moment in a car when the accelerator jams and you can't stop the car because the accelerator has been permanently jammed, or the brake has broken and you can't stop the car because you can't, your foot is on the brake, but the brake is not working. The problem, as we were discussing quite recently, is that there's not one accelerator and one brake.
Right.
In any given cell, there may be 20 accelerators that are broken that ultimately lead to cancer, or 20 brakes that are unmoored, unbroken. So in other words, in a single cancer cell, there might be 40, 50, 60 genes that are changed compared to a normal cell. Now, last week I saw a woman with breast cancer. She had two cancers growing in her breast, on her right breast. They were about 4 centimeters apart from each other. But even the most superficial genetic analysis suggested that these two cancers growing 4 centimeters away from each other in the same breast of this woman were not the same kind of cancer. So you could say to yourself, wait a second, this is a hopeless problem.
Mm.
The combination of genes, you know, 40 different genes here, 40 different genes, how will we ever? But one of the things that's very important and is being transformative right now is we're reorganizing this genetic anatomy and looking for points which are shared.
Right.
Maybe between one form of cancer and another, thinking outside silos. Maybe a variant of lung cancer, mm-hmm. which has its 40 genes, and a variant of breast cancer, which has its 40 genes, maybe they overlap a little bit. Mm-hmm. And could we develop medicines that target these abnormal genes? Mm-hmm. This, to me, represents an amazing moment in our understanding of cancer and an amazing opportunity to develop medicines that not only affect one cancer but across several other cancers. So that's the upside.
Yes.
This is what we would lose if we didn't. Yeah. If we didn't capitalize on the opportunity. The downside is, you know, the woman who sequenced in our laboratory, she sequenced 40 leukemias, and she found one such gene. She found a gene. It's a gene that modifies DNA. So it's a kind of very interesting gene because, you know, we think of cancers as having genes that control growth, but here's one that modifies DNA. What is it doing in all these leukemias? Now, she's a researcher, she's a chemist, but she's teaching night school.
Yeah.
Because she's worried that she won't get a job after her finishing up her postdoctoral work.
Right.
And that, to me, is terrifying.
Right.
We need this woman not to be in night school. We need this woman to be on the microscope at night.
Yeah.
You must have this.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And I worry because the message that people are hearing and is that it takes so long that if you have other life events that you want to be taken care of,
yeah.
you will not have a chance to get that first laboratory, that first grant,
yes.
until you hit 40. Those are the numbers. That's a real challenge for people to think that they're going to be essentially in a training mode
yes.
until they're 40 years old. Then they get yeah. to grow up. That's very painful.
That's very painful.
And we've got to find a way in which those people can be sustained.
And young people.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the energy that, you know.
Right, exactly. The creativity of that needs to be preserved. So I think we share that. I'm not sure we've got a way to solve that other than to say that the an awareness of that issue is one that I think needs to be translated into the political sphere as we think about what are the things. Government does a lot of things badly. This is actually something that government does pretty well.
Yes, it does well. Yeah.
Which is to actually invest in these kinds of long-term projects that have a big impact on all of us. And the process by which the selection process by which people are awarded grants, I think is still about the least corrupt process
yes.
that's out there. And I have to say, although I'm constantly whining about the issues, it is actually something that is very encouraging to see, and one only hopes that we have the continued opportunity to invest.
And let me speak a little bit to the quality of change that could happen if we brought all of this together. As I said, I talked about the upside of the science. Let me talk a little bit about the upside of the politics. I was having a conversation with Charles Sawyers, who mm-hmm. we know and admire. He is one of the researchers, like David, who's made that transition constantly between the laboratory and the clinic, from bench to bedside. And Charles, among other things, was instrumental in developing a medicine called imatinib, or Gleevec, which transformed the lives of patients with another form of leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia. This was yet another disease which was fatal. Patients would live 4 or 5 years, often they would go through just harrowing bone marrow transplants,
right.
and there was no other medicine for it. And then all of a sudden, through the efforts of Charles Sawyers and several other people, Brian Drucker among them, Nick Leiden among them, a medicine came around that would uniquely target the cancer cells and spare every other cell in the body. I mean, think about this medicine for a second. In other words, there's a molecule that will recognize among the billion cells, the multi-billion cells you have in your body, only the cancer cells. And it will selectively assassinate, kill those cancer cells, not all of them, because you have to keep the medicine, taking the medicine all the time, but it will send this disease into a complete chronic remission, such that the lifespan of now a patient with chronic myelogenous leukemia taking this medicine is no different than your lifespan, my lifespan without
right.
chronic myelogenous leukemia.
Right.
It's a wonderful story. So I said to Charles.
Just also mention one thing
yeah.
about that has not cured a single patient, right?
It has
an important element of this. Is that it's a very effective therapy without cure.
Yes.
So controlling cancer
maybe
is all a new dimension
exactly.
of the way we think about
yeah.
therapies.
So so bringing this back into the political dimension, I was talking to Charles, and one question that was very crucial in the early development of this molecule was that this was a collaboration between academic researchers and the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Eventually, a very successful collaboration.
Right.
But in its starting moments, a very antsy collaboration.
Yeah.
Because the pharmaceutical company that was involved said, well, wait a second, it's a wonderful drug, potentially. These were early days, but there are only 5,000 odd patients who ever get diagnosed with the disease every year, this illness every year. Should we be spending millions of dollars developing a drug that ultimately affects 5,000 patients with leukemia? And this was a big debate going on within the company. And then letters began to arrive from patients, some of whom had heard about the drug, people who had been heard about first person, third person. Letters began to arrive into the boxes of the pharmaceutical company, the executive, the CEO of this company, saying, please work on this drug. This is a life-saving, potentially life-saving medicine. And this was a nice story. So I said, Charles, well, how many letters came? And he said, there were 5,000 letters. So 5,000 letters, think about that number. Now imagine if every patient with breast cancer were to write a letter. Imagine if everyone with prostate cancer were to write a letter or to do something. This gets back to some of, you know, we were talking about this. Let's not pretend this is someone else's problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
This is the problem. This is one of the elemental problems of our generation. It is one of the central, most complex, most elemental questions that we've faced in our scientific history, one of them. So let's not pretend that someone else is going to come and solve it for us, because that's not going to happen. The only way to do it is, like that patient with CML who was saying to himself or herself, if this medicine does not get developed, my life is literally on the line.
Right.
I'm going to have to write this letter, 5,000 letters, 5,000 patients. Imagine the kind of power,
absolutely,
the transformative power that can come about. And you've seen
Given the history of this.
Yeah, and you've seen this with AIDS.
With the AIDS epidemic, it absolutely was a very powerful transformative.
Yeah, tell us about that.
This was largely driven by a community interacting with each other, becoming active and vocal. And as you know, there was a great deal of resistance on the part of many to get involved because of its stigma. And then people like, frankly, Elizabeth Taylor had a huge influence on bringing this to the attention of people who had the power to make a difference in Congress. It then became much more of a groundswell. But I think in the setting of cancer, absolutely, the power with which we can engage the community to become partners in this is enormous. And I will say one of the quotes from Mary Lasker that I particularly like is, if you think research is expensive, try disease.
That's right.
And I think it applies to cancer phenomenally well, because the devastating consequences, I mean, we've all had some, cancer has darkened the door of virtually every family in America and around the world. The idea that that we can become engaged and as a unifying organization, if you will, push toward making a difference. And it has happened in particular disease groups.
Yes.
People do organize around those disease entities, so I think that's really critically important. Absolutely. Well, Sid, I think if you look back, you've beautifully highlighted for us some of the ways in which there has been an ongoing process of discovery, new application. If you look forward, I think we can all see that with some of the emerging technologies, there is tremendous opportunity. I think one thing that's been particularly powerful, frankly, is the advent of the genomic age, if you will. Now that we understand or have sequenced every normal gene, we're also starting to get a handle on the cancer atlas. Some have likened to the idea of getting all of those genes that are present in a malignant cell population assembled is a little like putting together all the pieces in a crashed plane.
Right.
And it doesn't really get us to the point of understanding how, in sequence, these kinds of events interface with the environment, interface with other elements within the body that ultimately lead to the emergence of this process. But I think you and I share the perspective that by getting a fuller sense of not just what's happened in the cancer cell, but the tissues around it, that there are people we know who have high risk genetic profiles and yet don't get cancer. Maybe those people actually have something to teach us about how there are ways in which the body can defend itself against cancer. These kinds of things, I think, are ultimately where we all hope this will go, where instead of just being able to come up with some new formulas for how to treat the problem, will come up with new strategies for how to prevent
it. Absolutely.
And I think that's also one of the areas of great hope, is that this will uncover ways in which the cancer problem can become one of history. So are there other things that you would like to close with in terms of your view of what the next, the Emperor of All Maladies redux will look like?
Someone asked me if if I'm going to write volume 2.
Right.
And I said, there is no chance. If it's a statistical truth that I'll encounter cancer as a disease in my lifetime, then it is also a statistical truth that I will not be felled by another book that I'm trying to write about cancer. The question still remains what the future will look like. And I think one of the questions that I try to raise in the book is that I think it's unlikely that we'll fulfill the vision of the 1970s of eradicating cancer forever from our bodies, because one of the most chilling features, going back to the genes again, one of the most chilling features about cancer, isn't it, that the very genes that cause our embryos to grow, the very genes that cause our bodies to grow, are the genes that are corrupted in cancer. MYC, RAS, you can't say bye-bye MYC, because your embryo wouldn't grow. And Harold, who discovered one of these important genes, very, very, very simply put it, cancer is the distorted version of our normal selves. And that's the problem, isn't it? It's not only a biological problem, it essentially creates a kind of philosophical conundrum. Because how do you then take a distortion of normalcy and restore that? Because it's so close to normalcy. It's just that little twist outside normalcy that ultimately gives the cancer cell or the cancer cells their phenomenal power, the very features that allow our cells to survive, our bodies to survive. If you corrupt those features, you get cancer. So in a very, not even in a metaphorical sense, but in a very real sense, cancer is the darker edge of the very things that make us human. So the idea that we will eradicate this elemental family of illnesses from our future is very unlikely. But think about what would happen if we could convert many of these cancers into chronic diseases.
Absolutely.
Think about what would it do to... I remember, just to give you one example, there was an amazing moment in my medical training, kind of a funny moment in which, when patients come into the hospital, you take their history and you write down, what they're suffering from and so forth. And then there's a part in the medical examination which you say past medical history, other things that have happened in their lives. So there was a moment in, I was in the emergency room as a young intern in 1990-something, and a man came in with a heart attack, an acute coronary, and I took his, et cetera, et cetera. I took his history and so forth and documented it. He was the right age group that has this kind of risk of heart attack, and I was looking down his past medical history. I wrote past medical history, and I wrote HIV/AIDS on triple therapy for drugs.
Yes.
And it sent a chill up my spine, the idea of writing in past medical history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? This man, in other words, the diagnosis of HIV for him, this man, was an incidental.
Yes.
Yeah, he was now afflicted by another illness, but which had really nothing to do. He was living out the lifespan of other chronic illnesses, and for him, HIV was past medical history. In 1984,
absolutely,
this would have been unimaginable.
This was
a death sentence. It was unimaginable that someone with HIV would come in and say, incidentally, I also happen to, by the way, among other things, I also happen to be HIV positive and have AIDS. So,
and it's all because of research, actually.
And it's all because of research, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, going back to Mary Lasker, if you think research is expensive, try disease.
Well, Sid, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for what you've done with this book.
Thank you.
I think we have some questions. Okay.